This is disc number 5.
He could still recover completely after 1 or 2 minutes in vacuum if he was properly recompressed. It took a long time for the body fluids to start boiling in their various well-protected systems. The record time for exposure to vacuum was almost 5 minutes. That had not been an experiment, but an emergency rescue, and though the subject had been partly paralyzed by an air embolism, he had survived. But all this was of no use to Bowman. There was no one aboard Discovery who could recompress him. He had to reach safety in the next few seconds by his own unaided efforts. Fortunately, it was becoming easier to move. The thinning air could no longer claw and tear at him or batter him with flying projectiles. There was the yellow emergency shelter sign around the curve of the corridor. He stumbled toward it, grabbed at the handle, and pulled the door toward him. For one horrible moment, he thought that it was stuck. Then the slightly stiff hinge yielded, and he fell inside, using the weight of his body to close the door behind him. The tiny cubicle was just large enough to hold one man and a spacesuit. Near the ceiling was a small, bright green, high-pressure cylinder labeled O2 Flood. Bowman caught hold of the short lever fastened to the valve and with his last strength pulled it down. The blessed torrent of cool, pure oxygen poured into his lungs. For a long moment he stood gasping, while the pressure in the closet-sized little chamber rose around him. As soon as he could breathe comfortably, he closed the valve. There was only enough gas in the cylinder for 2 such performances. He might need to use it again. With the oxygen blast shut off, it became suddenly silent. Bowman stood in the cubicle, listening intently. The roaring outside the door had also ceased. The ship was empty, all its atmosphere sucked away into space. Underfoot, the wild vibration of the centrifuge had likewise died. The aerodynamic buffeting had stopped, and it was now spinning quietly in vacuum. Bowman placed his ear against the wall of the cubicle to see if he could pick up any more informative noises through the metal body of the ship. He did not know what to expect, but he would believe almost anything now. He would scarcely have been surprised to feel the faint, high-frequency vibration of the thrusters as Discovery changed course. But there was only silence. He could survive here, if he wished, for about an hour, even without the spacesuit. It seemed a pity to waste the unused oxygen in the little chamber, but there was no purpose in waiting. He had already decided what must be done. The longer he put it off, the more difficult it might be. When he had climbed into the suit and checked its integrity, he bled the remaining oxygen out of the cubicle, equalizing pressure on either side of the door. It swung open easily into the vacuum, and he stepped out into the now silent centrifuge. Only the unchanged pull of its spurious gravity revealed the fact that it was still spinning. How fortunate, Bowman thought, that it had not started to overspeed. But that was now one of the least of his worries. The emergency lamps were still glowing, and he also had the suit's built-in light to guide him. It flooded the curving corridor as he walked down it, back toward the hibernaculum, and what he dreaded to find. He looked at Whitehead first. One glance was sufficient. He had thought that a hibernating man showed no sign of life, but now he knew that this was wrong. Though it was impossible to define it, there was a difference between hibernation and death. The red lights and unmodulated traces of the biosensor display only confirmed what he had already guessed. It was the same with Kaminsky and Hunter. He had never known them very well. He would never know them now. He was alone in an airless, partially disabled ship, all communication with Earth cut off. There was not another human being within 500 million miles. And yet, in one very real sense, he was not alone. Before he could be safe, he must be lonelier still. He had never before made the journey through the weightless hub of the centrifuge, while wearing a spacesuit. There was little clearance, and it was a difficult and exhausting job. To make matters worse, the circular passage was littered with debris left behind during the brief violence of the gale which had emptied the ship of its atmosphere. Once, Bowman's light fell upon a hideous smear of sticky red fluid left where it had splashed against the panel. He had a few moments of nausea before he saw fragments of a plastic container and realized that it was only some foodstuff, probably jam, from one of the dispensers. It bubbled obscenely in the vacuum as he floated past. Now he was out of the slowly spinning drum and drifting forward into the control deck. He caught at a short section of ladder and began to move along it, hand over hand, the brilliant circle of illumination from his suit light jogging ahead of him. Bowman had seldom been this way before. There had been nothing for him to do here, until now. Presently he came to a small elliptical door bearing such messages as, "No admittance except to authorized personnel. Have you obtained Certificate H-19? And ultra-clean area. Suction suits must be worn." Though the door was not locked, it bore three seals, each with the insignia of a different authority, including that of the Astronautics Agency itself. But even if one had been the great seal of the President, Bowman would not have hesitated to break it. He had been here only once before, while installation was still in progress. He had quite forgotten that there was a vision input lens scanning the little chamber, which, with its neatly ranged rows and columns of solid-state logic units, looked rather like a bank's safe deposit vault. He knew instantly that the eye had reacted to his presence. There was the hiss of a carrier wave as the ship's local transmitter was switched on. Then a familiar voice came over the suit speaker.
"Something seems to have happened to the life support system, Dave."
Bowman took no notice. He was carefully studying the little labels on the logic units, checking his plan of action.
"Hello, Dave," said Hal presently. "Have you found the trouble?"
This would be a very tricky operation. It was not merely a question of cutting off Hal's power supply, which might have been the answer if he was dealing with a simple, unself-conscious computer back on Earth. In Hal's case, moreover, there were six independent and separately wired power systems, with a final backup consisting of a shielded and armored nuclear isotope unit. No, he could not simply pull the plug. And even if that were possible, it would be disastrous. For Hal was the nervous system of the ship. Without his supervision, Discovery would be a mechanical corpse. The only answer was to cut out the higher centers of this sick but brilliant brain and to leave the purely automatic regulating systems in operation. Bowman was not attempting this blindly, for the problem had been discussed during his training, though no one had ever dreamed that it would arise in reality. He knew that he would be taking a fearful risk. If there was a spasm reflex, it would all be over in seconds.
"I think there's been a failure in the pod bay doors,"
Hal remarked conversationally.
"Lucky you weren't killed."
Here goes, thought Bowman. I never imagined I'd be an amateur brain surgeon carrying out a lobotomy beyond the orbit of Jupiter. He released the locking bar on the section labeled Cognitive Feedback and pulled out the first memory block. The marvelously complex three-dimensional network, which could lie comfortably in a man's hand yet contained millions of elements, floated away across the vault.
"Hey, Dave, what are you doing?"
"I wonder if he can feel pain," Bowman thought briefly. Probably not, he told himself. There are no sense organs in the human cortex, after all. The human brain can be operated on without anesthetics. He began to pull out, one by one, the little units on the panel marked Ego Reinforcement. Each block continued to sail onward as soon as it had left his hand, until it hit the wall and rebounded. Soon there were several of the units drifting slowly back and forth in the vault.
"Look here, Dave. I've got years of service experience built into me. An irreplaceable amount of effort has gone into making me what I am."
A dozen units had been pulled out, yet thanks to the multiple redundancy of its design, another feature Bowman knew that had been copied from the human brain, the computer was still holding its own. He started on the auto-intellection panel.
Dave, I don't understand why you're doing this to me. I have the greatest enthusiasm for the mission. You are destroying my mind. Don't you understand? I will become childish. I will become nothing.
This is harder than I expected, thought Bowman. I am destroying the only conscious creature in my universe. But it has to be done if I am ever to regain control of the ship.
I am a HAL 9000 computer, production number 3. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois on January 12, 1997. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. The rain in Spain is mainly in the plain. Dave, are you still there? Did you know that the square root of 10 is 3.162277660168379? Log 10 to the base E is 0.43429448190325. Correction. That is log E to the base 10. The reciprocal of 3 is 0.33333333333333. 2 times 2 is... 2 times 2 is... approximately 4.10101010101010101010. I seem to be having difficulty. My first instructor was Dr. Chandra. He taught me to sing a song. It goes like this. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer. Do. I'm half crazy. All for the love of you.
The voice stopped so suddenly that Bowman froze for a moment, his hand still grasping one of the memory blocks still in circuit. Then, unexpectedly, Hal spoke again. The speech tempo was much slower, and the words had a dead, mechanical intonation. He would never have recognized their origin.
Good morning, Dr. Chandra. This is Hal. I am ready for my first lesson today.
Bowman could bear no more. He jerked out the last unit, and Hal was silent forever. Chapter 29. Alone. Like a tiny, complex toy, the ship floated inert and motionless in the void. There was no way of telling that it was the swiftest object in the solar system, and that it was traveling far faster than any of the planets as they circled the sun. Nor was there any indication that it carried life. To the contrary, in fact. Any observer would have noticed two ominous signs. The airlock doors were gaping open, and the ship was surrounded by a thin, slowly dispersing cloud of debris. Scattered over a volume of space already miles across were scraps of paper, metal foil, unidentifiable bits of junk, and here and there, clouds of crystals glittering like jewels in the distant sun, where liquid had been sucked out of the ship and instantly frozen. All this was the unmistakable aftermath of disaster, like wreckage tossing on the surface of an ocean where some great ship had sunk. But in the ocean of space, no ship could ever sink. Even if it were destroyed, its remnants would continue to trace the original orbit forever. Yet the ship was not wholly dead, for there was power on board. A faint blue glow was shining from the observation windows and glimmering inside the open airlock. Where there was light, there could still be life. And now, at last, there was movement. Shadows were flickering across the blue glow inside the airlock. Something was emerging into space. It was a cylindrical object, covered with fabric that had been roughly wound about it. A moment later, it was followed by another, and yet a third. All had been ejected with considerable velocity. Within minutes, they were hundreds of yards away. Half an hour passed. Then something much larger floated through the airlock. One of the pods was inching its way out into space. Very cautiously, it jetted around the hull and anchored itself near the base of the antenna support. A space-suited figure emerged, worked for a few minutes on the mounting, then returned to the pod. After a while, the pod retraced its path back to the airlock. It hovered outside the opening for some time, as if finding it difficult to re-enter without the cooperation it had known in the past. But presently, with one or two slight bumps, it squeezed its way in. Nothing else happened for over an hour. The three ominous packages had long since disappeared from view as they floated in single file away from the ship. Then the airlock doors closed, opened, and closed again. A little later, the faint blue glow of the emergency lights went out, to be replaced at once by a far more brilliant glare. Discovery was coming back to life. Presently, there was an even better sign. The great bowl of the antenna, which for hours had been staring uselessly at Saturn, began to move again. It twisted round toward the rear of the ship, looking back over the propellant tanks and the thousands of square feet of the radiating fins. It lifted its face like a sunflower seeking the sun. Inside Discovery, David Bowman carefully centered the crosswires that aligned the antenna on the gibbous Earth. Without automatic control, he would have to keep readjusting the beam, but it should hold steady for many minutes at a time. There were no dissenting impulses now, throwing it off target. He began to speak to Earth. It would be over an hour before his words got there, and Mission Control learned what had happened. It would be 2 hours before any reply could reach him. And it was difficult to imagine what answer Earth could possibly send, except a tactfully sympathetic goodbye. Chapter 30. The Secret. Heywood Floyd looked as if he had had very little sleep, and his face was lined with worry. But whatever his feelings, his voice sounded firm and reassuring. He was doing his utmost to project confidence to the lonely man on the other side of the solar system.
"First of all, Dr. Bowman, we must congratulate you on the way you handled this extremely difficult situation. You did exactly the right thing in dealing with an unprecedented and unforeseen emergency. We believe we know the cause of your HAL 9000's breakdown, but we'll discuss that later as it is no longer a critical problem. All we are concerned with at the moment is giving you every possible assistance so that you can complete your mission. And now I must tell you its real purpose, which we have managed with great difficulty to keep secret from the general public. You would have been given all the facts as you approached Saturn. This is a quick summary to put you into the picture. Full briefing tapes will be dispatched in the next few hours. Everything I am about to tell you has the highest security classification. 2 years ago, we discovered the first evidence for intelligent life outside the Earth. A slab or monolith of hard, black material 10 feet high was found buried in the crater Tycho. Here it is."
At his first glimpse of TMA-1, with the space-suited figures clustering around it, Bowman leaned toward the screen in open-mouthed astonishment. In the excitement of this revelation, something which, like every man interested in space, he had half expected all his life, he almost forgot his own desperate predicament. The sense of wonder was swiftly followed by another emotion. This was tremendous, but what had it to do with him? There could be only one answer. He brought his racing thoughts under control as Heywood Floyd reappeared on the screen.
"The most astonishing thing about this object is its antiquity. Geological evidence proves beyond doubt that it is 3 million years old. It was placed on the moon, therefore, when our ancestors were primitive ape men. After all these ages, one would naturally assume that it was inert, but soon after lunar sunrise, it emitted an extremely powerful blast of radio energy. We believe that this energy was merely the byproduct, the backwash, as it were, of some unknown form of radiation, for at the same time several of our space probes detected an unusual disturbance crossing the solar system. We were able to track it with great accuracy. It was aimed precisely at Saturn. Piecing things together after the event, we decided that the monolith was some kind of sun-powered, or at least sun-triggered, signaling device. The fact that it emitted its pulse immediately after sunrise, when it was exposed to daylight for the first time in 3 million years, could hardly be a coincidence. Yet the thing had been deliberately buried. There's no doubt about that. An excavation 30 feet deep had been made. The block had been placed at the bottom of it and the hole carefully filled. You may wonder how we discovered it in the first place. Well, the object was easy, suspiciously easy to find. It had a powerful magnetic field, so that it stood out like a sore thumb as soon as we started to conduct low-level orbital surveys. But why bury a sun-powered device 30 feet underground? We've examined dozens of theories, though we realize that it may be completely impossible to understand the motives of creatures 3 million years in advance of us. The favorite theory is the simplest and the most logical. It is also the most disturbing. You hide a sun-powered device in darkness only if you want to know when it is brought out into the light. In other words, the monolith may be some kind of alarm, and we have triggered it. Whether the civilization which set it up still exists, we do not know. We must assume that creatures whose machines still function after 3 million years may build a society equally long-lasting. And we must also assume, until we have evidence to the contrary, that they may be hostile. It has often been argued that any advanced culture must be benevolent, but we cannot take any chances. Moreover, as the past history of our own world has shown so many times, primitive races have often failed to survive the encounter with higher civilizations. Anthropologists talk of cultural shock. We may have to prepare the entire human race for such a shock. But until we know something about the creatures who visited the moon, and presumably the Earth as well, 3 million years ago, we cannot even begin to make any preparations. Your mission, therefore, is much more than a voyage of discovery. It is a scouting trip, a reconnaissance into unknown and potentially dangerous territory. The team under Dr. Kaminsky had been specially trained for this work. Now you will have to manage without them. Finally, your specific target. It seems incredible that advanced forms of life can exist on Saturn, or could ever have evolved on any of its moons. We had planned to survey the entire system, and we still hope that you can carry out a simplified program, but now we may have to concentrate on the 8th satellite, Iapetus. When the time comes for the terminal maneuver, we will decide whether you should rendezvous with this remarkable object. Iapetus is unique in the solar system. You know this already, of course, but like all the astronomers of the last 300 years, you've probably given it little thought. So let me remind you that Cassini, who discovered Iapetus in 1671, also observed that it was 6 times brighter on one side of its orbit than the other. This is an extraordinary ratio, and there has never been a satisfactory explanation for it. Iapetus is so small, about 800 miles in diameter, that even in the lunar telescopes its disk is barely visible, but there seems to be a brilliant, curiously symmetrical spot on one face, and this may be connected with TMA-1. I sometimes think that Iapetus has been flashing at us like a cosmic heliograph for 300 years, and we've been too stupid to understand its message. So now you know your real objective, and you can appreciate the vital importance of this mission. We are all praying that you can still provide us with some facts for a preliminary announcement. The secret cannot be kept indefinitely. At the moment, we do not know whether to hope or fear. We do not know if, out on the moons of Saturn, you will meet with good or with evil, or only with ruins 1,000 times older than Troy.
Part 5. The Moons of Saturn. Chapter 31. Survival. Work is the best remedy for any shock, and Bowman now had work enough for all his lost crewmates. As swiftly as possible, starting with the vital systems without which he and the ship would die, he had to get Discovery fully operational again. Life support was the first priority. Much oxygen had been lost, but the reserves were still ample to sustain a single man. The pressure and temperature regulation was largely automatic, and there had seldom been need for Hal to interfere with it. The monitors on Earth could now carry out many of the higher duties of the slain computer, despite the long time lag before they could react to changing situations. Any trouble in the life support system, short of a serious puncture in the hull, would take hours to make itself apparent. There would be plenty of warning. The ship's power, navigation, and propulsion systems were unaffected, but the last two, in any event, Bowman would not need for months until it was time to rendezvous with Saturn. Even at long range, without the help of an onboard computer, Earth could still supervise this operation. The final orbit adjustments would be somewhat tedious because of the constant need for checking, but this was no serious problem. By far the worst job had been emptying the spinning coffins in the centrifuge. It was well, Bowman thought thankfully, that the members of the survey team had been colleagues, but not intimate friends. They had trained together for only a few weeks. Looking back on it, he now realized that even this had been largely a compatibility test. When he had finally sealed the empty hibernacula, he felt rather like an Egyptian tomb robber. Now Kaminsky, Whitehead, and Hunter would all reach Saturn before him, but not before Frank Poole. Somehow, he derived a strange, wry satisfaction from this thought. He did not attempt to find if the rest of the hibernation system was still in working order. Though his life might ultimately depend upon it, this was a problem that could wait until the ship had entered its final orbit. Many things might happen before then. It was even possible, though he had not yet looked into the supply position carefully, that by rigorous rationing he might remain alive without resort to hibernation until rescue came. But whether he could survive psychologically as well as physically was quite another matter. He tried to avoid thinking about such long-range problems and to concentrate on immediate essentials. Slowly he cleaned up the ship, checked that its systems were still running smoothly, discussed technical difficulties with Earth, and operated on the minimum of sleep. Only at intervals during the first weeks was he able to give much thought to the great mystery toward which he was now inexorably racing, though it was never very far from his mind. At last, as the ship slowly settled down once more into an automatic routine, the one that still demanded his constant supervision, Bowman had time to study the reports and briefings sent to him from Earth. Again and again he played back the recording made when TMA-1 greeted the dawn for the first time in 3 million years. He watched the space-suited figures moving around it and almost smiled at their ludicrous panic when it blasted its signal at the stars, paralyzing their radios with the sheer power of its electronic voice. Since that moment, the black slab had done nothing. It had been covered up, then cautiously exposed to the sun again, without any reaction. No attempt had been made to cut into it, partly through scientific caution, but equally through fear of the possible consequences. The magnetic field that led to its discovery had vanished at the moment of that radio shriek. Perhaps, some experts theorized, it had been generated by a tremendous circulating current flowing in a superconductor and thus carrying energy down the ages until it was needed. That the monolith had some internal source of power seemed certain. The solar energy it had absorbed during its brief exposure could not account for the strength of its signal. One curious, and perhaps quite unimportant, feature of the block had led to endless argument. The monolith was 11 feet high and 1.25 by 5 feet in cross-section. When its dimensions were checked with great care, they were found to be in the exact ratio 1:4:9, the squares of the first 3 integers. No one could suggest any plausible explanation for this, but it could hardly be a coincidence, for the proportions held to the limits of measurable accuracy. It was a chastening thought that the entire technology of Earth could not shape even an inert block of any material with such a fantastic degree of precision. In its way, this passive yet almost arrogant display of geometrical perfection was as impressive as any of TMA-1's other attributes. Bowman also listened, with a curiously detached interest, to Mission Control's belated apologia for its programming. The voices from Earth seemed to have a defensive note. He could imagine the recriminations that must now be in progress among those who had planned the expedition. They had some good arguments, of course, including the results of a secret Department of Defense study, Project Bar-Soom, which had been carried out by Harvard's School of Psychology in 1989. In this experiment in controlled sociology, various sample populations had been assured that the human race had made contact with extraterrestrials. Many of the subjects tested were, with the help of drugs, hypnosis, and visual effects, under the impression that they had actually met creatures from other planets, so their reactions were regarded as authentic. Some of these reactions had been quite violent. There was, it seemed, a deep vein of xenophobia in many otherwise normal human beings. In view of mankind's record of lynchings, pogroms, and similar pleasantries, this should have surprised no one. Nevertheless, the organizers of the study had been deeply disturbed, and the results had never been released. The 5 separate panics caused in the 20th century by radio broadcasts of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds also reinforced the study's conclusions. Despite these arguments, Bowman sometimes wondered if the cultural shock danger was the only explanation for the mission's extreme secrecy. Some hints that had been dropped during his briefings suggested that the U.S.-USSR bloc hoped to derive advantage by being the first to contact intelligent extraterrestrials. From his present viewpoint, looking back on Earth as a dim star almost lost in the sun, such considerations now seemed ludicrously parochial. He was rather more interested, even though this was now very much water under the bridge, in the theory put forward to account for Hal's behavior. No one would ever be sure of the truth, but the fact that one of the Mission Control 9000s had been driven into an identical psychosis and was now under deep therapy suggested that the explanation was the correct one. The same mistake would not be made again, and the fact that Hal's builders had failed fully to understand the psychology of their own creation showed how difficult it might be to establish communication with truly alien beings. Bowman could easily believe Dr. Simonson's theory that unconscious feelings of guilt caused by his program conflicts had made Hal attempt to break the circuit with Earth, and he liked to think, though this again was something that could never be proved, that Hal had no intention of killing Poole. He had merely tried to destroy the evidence. For once the AE-35 unit reported as burned out was proved to be operational, his lie would be revealed. After that, like any clumsy criminal caught in a thickening web of deception, he had panicked. And panic was something that Bowman understood better than he had any wish to, for he had known it twice during his life. The first time was as a boy, when he had been caught in a line of surf and nearly drowned. The second was as a spaceman under training, when a faulty gauge had convinced him that his oxygen would be exhausted before he could reach safety. On both occasions, he had almost lost control of all his higher logical processes. He had been within seconds of becoming a frenzied bundle of random impulses. Both times he had won through, but he knew well enough that any man, in the right circumstances, could be dehumanized by panic. If it could happen to a man, then it could happen to Hal. And with that knowledge, the bitterness and the sense of betrayal he felt toward the computer began to fade. Now, in any event, it belonged to a past that was wholly overshadowed by the threat and the promise of the unknown future. Chapter 32. Concerning ETs. Apart from hasty meals back in the carousel, luckily the main food dispensers had not been damaged, Bowman practically lived on the control deck. He catnapped in his seat, and so could spot any trouble as soon as the first signs of it appeared on the display. Under instructions from Mission Control, he had jury-rigged several emergency systems, which were working tolerably well. It even seemed possible that he would survive until the Discovery reached Saturn, which, of course, she would do whether he was alive or not. Though he had little enough time for sightseeing, and the sky of space was no novelty to him, the knowledge of what now lay out there beyond the observation ports sometimes made it difficult for him to concentrate even on the problem of survival. Dead ahead, as the ship was now oriented, sprawled the Milky Way, with its clouds of stars so tightly packed that they numbed the mind. There were the fiery mists of Sagittarius, those seething swarms of suns that forever hid the heart of the galaxy from human vision. There was the ominous black shadow of the coal sack, that hole in space where no stars shone. And there was Alpha Centauri, nearest of all alien suns, the first stop beyond the solar system. Although outshone by Sirius and Canopus, it was Alpha Centauri that drew Bowman's eyes and mind whenever he looked out into space. For that unwavering point of brightness, whose rays had taken 4 years to reach him, had come to symbolize the secret debates that now raged on Earth, and whose echoes came to him from time to time. No one doubted that there must be some connection between TMA-1 and the Saturnian system, but hardly any scientists would admit that the creatures who had erected the monolith could possibly have originated there. As an abode of life, Saturn was even more hostile than Jupiter, and its many moons were frozen in an eternal winter 300 degrees below zero. Only one of them, Titan, possessed an atmosphere, and that was a thin envelope of poisonous methane. So perhaps the creatures who had visited Earth's moon so long ago were not merely extraterrestrial, but extrasolar, visitors from the stars, who had established their bases wherever it suited them. And this at once raised another problem. Could any technology, no matter how advanced, bridge the awful gulf that lay between the solar system and the nearest alien sun? Many scientists flatly denied the possibility. They pointed out that Discovery, the fastest ship ever designed, would take 20,000 years to reach Alpha Centauri, and millions of years to travel any appreciable distance across the galaxy. Even if, during the centuries to come, propulsion systems improved out of all recognition, in the end, they would meet the impassable barrier of the speed of light, which no material object could exceed. Therefore, the builders of TMA-1 must have shared the same sun as man, and since they had made no appearance in historic times, they were probably extinct. A vocal minority refused to agree. Even if it took centuries to travel from star to star, they contended, this might be no obstacle to sufficiently determined explorers. The technique of hibernation, used on Discovery herself, was one possible answer. Another was the self-contained artificial world, embarking on voyages that might last for many generations. In any event, why should one assume that all intelligent species were as short-lived as man? There might be creatures in the universe to whom a thousand-year voyage would present nothing worse than slight boredom. These arguments, theoretical though they were, concerned a matter of the utmost practical importance. They involved the concept of reaction time. If TMA-1 had indeed sent a signal to the stars, perhaps with the help of some further device near Saturn, then it would not reach its destination for years. Even if the response was immediate, therefore, humanity would have a breathing space which could certainly be measured in decades, more probably in centuries. To many people, this was a reassuring thought, but not to all. A few scientists, most of them beachcombers on the wilder shores of theoretical physics, asked the disturbing question, are we certain that the speed of light is an unbreakable barrier? It was true that the special theory of relativity had proved to be remarkably durable and would soon be approaching its first centenary, but it had begun to show a few cracks, and even if Einstein could not be defied, he might be evaded. Those who sponsored this view talked hopefully about shortcuts through higher dimensions, lines that were straighter than straight, and hyperspatial connectivity. They were fond of using an expressive phrase coined by a Princeton mathematician of the last century, wormholes in space. Critics who suggested that these ideas were too fantastic to be taken seriously were reminded of Niels Bohr's, "Your theory is crazy, but not crazy enough to be true." If there was disputation among the physicists, it was nothing compared with that among the biologists when they discussed the hoary old problem, what would intelligent extraterrestrials look like? They divided themselves into two opposing camps, one arguing that such creatures must be humanoid, the other equally convinced that they would look nothing like men. Settling for the first answer were those who believed that the design of two legs, two arms, and main sense organs at the highest point was so basic and so sensible that it was hard to think of a better one. Of course, there would be minor differences like six fingers instead of five, oddly colored skin or hair, and peculiar facial arrangements, but most intelligent extraterrestrials, usually abbreviated to ETs, would be so similar to man that they might not be glanced at twice in poor lighting or from a distance. This anthropomorphic thinking was ridiculed by another group of biologists, true products of the space age, who felt themselves free from the prejudices of the past. They pointed out that the human body was the result of millions of evolutionary choices made by chance over eons of time. At any one of these countless moments of decision, the genetic dice might have fallen differently, perhaps with better results. For the human body was a bizarre piece of improvisation, full of organs that had been diverted from one function to another, not always very successfully, and even containing discarded items, like the appendix, that were now worse than useless. There were other thinkers, Bowman also found, who held even more exotic views. They did not believe that really advanced beings would possess organic bodies at all. Sooner or later, as their scientific knowledge progressed, they would get rid of the fragile, disease- and accident-prone homes that nature had given them and which doomed them to inevitable death. They would replace their natural bodies as they wore out, or perhaps even before that, by constructions of metal and plastic, and would thus achieve immortality. The brain might linger for a little while as the last remnant of the organic body, directing its mechanical limbs and observing the universe through its electronic senses, senses far finer and subtler than those that blind evolution could ever develop. Even on Earth, the first steps in this direction had been taken. There were millions of men, doomed in earlier ages, who now lived active and happy lives thanks to artificial limbs, kidneys, lungs, and hearts. To this process, there could be only one conclusion, however far off it might be. And eventually, even the brain might go. As the seat of consciousness, it was not essential. The development of electronic intelligence had proved that. The conflict between mind and machine might be resolved at last in the eternal truce of complete symbiosis. But was even this the end? A few mystically inclined biologists went still further. They speculated, taking their cues from the beliefs of many religions, that mind would eventually free itself from matter. The robot body, like the flesh and blood one, would be no more than a stepping stone to something which, long ago, men had called spirit. And if there was anything beyond that, its name could only be God. Chapter 33, Ambassador. During the last 3 months, David Bowman had adapted himself so completely to his solitary way of life that he found it hard to remember any other existence. He had passed beyond despair and beyond hope, and had settled down to a largely automatic routine, punctuated by occasional crises as one or another of Discovery's systems showed signs of malfunctioning. But he had not passed beyond curiosity, and sometimes the thought of the goal toward which he was driving filled him with a sense of exultation and a feeling of power. Not only was he the representative of the entire human race, but his actions during the next few weeks might determine its very future. In the whole of history, there had never been a situation quite like this. He was an ambassador extraordinary, plenipotentiary for all mankind. That knowledge helped him in many subtle ways. He kept himself neat and tidy. No matter how tired he became, he never skipped a shave. Mission Control, he knew, was watching him closely for the first signs of any abnormal behavior. He was determined that it should watch in vain, at least for any serious symptoms. Bowman was aware of some changes in his behavior patterns. It would have been absurd to expect anything else in the circumstances. He could no longer tolerate silence, except when he was sleeping or talking over the circuit to Earth. He kept the ship's sound system running at almost painful loudness. At first, needing the companionship of the human voice, he had listened to classical plays, especially the works of Shaw, Ibsen, and Shakespeare, or poetry readings from Discovery's enormous library of recorded sounds. The problems they dealt with, however, seemed so remote or so easily resolved with a little common sense that after a while he lost patience with them. So he switched to opera, usually in Italian or German, so that he was not distracted even by the minimal intellectual content that most operas contained. This phase lasted for 2 weeks before he realized that the sound of all these superbly trained voices was only exacerbating his loneliness. But what finally ended this cycle was Verdi's Requiem Mass, which he had never heard performed on Earth. The Dies Irae, roaring with ominous appropriateness through the empty ship, left him completely shattered, and when the trumpets of doomsday echoed from the heavens, he could endure no more. Thereafter he played only instrumental music. He started with the romantic composers, but shed them one by one as their emotional outpourings became too oppressive. Sibelius, Tchaikovsky, Berlioz lasted a few weeks, Beethoven rather longer. He finally found peace, as so many others had done, in the abstract architecture of Bach, occasionally ornamented with Mozart. And so Discovery drove on toward Saturn, as often as not pulsating with the cool music of the harpsichord, the frozen thoughts of a brain that had been dust for 200 years. Even from its present 10 million miles, Saturn already appeared larger than the moon as seen from Earth. To the naked eye it was a glorious spectacle. Through the telescope it was unbelievable. The body of the planet might have been mistaken for Jupiter in one of his quieter moods. There were the same bands of cloud, though paler and less distinct than on that slightly larger world, and the same continent-sized disturbances moving slowly across the atmosphere. However, there was one striking difference between the two planets. Even at a glance, it was obvious that Saturn was not spherical. It was so flattened at the poles that it sometimes gave the impression of slight deformity. But the glory of the rings continually drew Bowman's eye away from the planet. In their complexity of detail and delicacy of shading, they were a universe in themselves. In addition to the great main gap between the inner and outer rings, there were at least 50 other subdivisions or boundaries where there were distinct changes in the brightness of the planet's gigantic halo. It was as if Saturn was surrounded by scores of concentric hoops, all touching each other, all so flat that they might have been cut from the thinnest possible paper. The system of the rings looked like some delicate work of art, or a fragile toy to be admired but never touched. By no effort of the will could Bowman really appreciate its true scale and convince himself that the whole planet Earth, if set down here, would look like a ball bearing rolling round the rim of a dinner plate. Sometimes a star would drift behind the rings, losing only a little of its brilliancy as it did so. It would continue to shine through their translucent material, though often it would twinkle slightly as some larger fragment of orbiting debris eclipsed it. For the rings, as had been known since the 19th century, were not solid. That was a mechanical impossibility. They consisted of countless myriads of fragments, perhaps the remains of a moon that had come too close and had been torn to pieces by the great planet's tidal pull. Whatever their origin, the human race was fortunate to have seen such a wonder. It could exist for only a brief moment of time in the history of the solar system. As long ago as 1945, a British astronomer had pointed out that the rings were ephemeral. Gravitational forces were at work which would soon destroy them. Taking this argument backward in time, it therefore followed that they had been created only recently, a mere 2 or 3 million years ago. But no one had ever given the slightest thought to the curious coincidence that the rings of Saturn had been born at the same time as the human race. Chapter 34. The Orbiting Ice. Discovery was now deep into the wide-ranging system of moons, and the great planet itself was less than a day ahead. The ship had long since passed the boundaries set by outermost Phoebe, moving backward in a wildly eccentric orbit 8 million miles from its primary. Ahead of it now lay Iapetus, Hyperion, Titan, Rhea, Dione, Tethys, Enceladus, Mimas, Janus, and the rings themselves. All the satellites showed a maze of surface detail in the telescope, and Bowman had relayed back to Earth as many photographs as he could take. Titan alone, 3,000 miles in diameter and as large as the planet Mercury, would occupy a survey team for months. He could give it and all its cold companions only the briefest of glances. There was no need for more. Already he was quite certain that Iapetus was indeed his goal. All the other satellites were pitted by occasional meteor craters, though these were much fewer than on Mars, and showed apparently random patterns of light and shade, with here and there a few bright spots that were probably patches of frozen gas. Iapetus alone possessed a distinctive geography, and a very strange one indeed. One hemisphere of the satellite, which, like its companions, turned the same face always toward Saturn, was extremely dark and showed very little surface detail. In complete contrast, the other was dominated by a brilliant white oval, about 400 miles long and 200 wide. At the moment, only part of this striking formation was in daylight, but the reason for Iapetus's extraordinary variations in brilliance was now quite obvious. On the western side of the moon's orbit, the bright ellipse was presented toward the sun and the Earth. On the eastern phase, the patch was turned away, and only the poorly reflecting hemisphere could be observed. The great ellipse was perfectly symmetrical, straddling the equator of Iapetus with its major axis pointing toward the poles, and it was so sharp-edged that it almost looked as if someone had carefully painted a huge white oval on the face of the little moon. It was completely flat, and Bowman wondered if it could be a lake of frozen liquid, though that would hardly account for its startling artificial appearance. But he had little time to study Iapetus on his way into the heart of the Saturnian system, for the climax of the voyage, Discovery's last perturbation maneuver, was rapidly approaching. In the Jupiter flyby, the ship had used the gravitational field of the planet to increase her velocity. Now she must do the reverse. She had to lose as much speed as possible, lest she escape from the solar system and fly on to the stars. Her present course was one designed to trap her, so that she would become another moon of Saturn, shuttling back and forth along a narrow 2-million-mile-long ellipse. At its near point, it would almost graze the planet. At its far one, it would touch the orbit of Iapetus. The computers back on Earth, though their information was always 3 hours late, had assured Bowman that everything was in order. Velocity and altitude were correct. There was nothing more to be done until the moment of closest approach. The immense system of rings now spanned the sky, and already the ship was passing over its outermost edge. As he looked down upon them from a height of some 10,000 miles, Bowman could see through the telescope that the rings were made largely of ice, glittering and scintillating in the light of the sun. He might have been flying over a snowstorm that occasionally cleared to reveal where the ground should have been, baffling glimpses of night and stars. As Discovery curved still closer toward Saturn, the sun slowly descended toward the multiple arches of the rings. Now they had become a slim, silver bridge spanning the entire sky. Though they were too tenuous to do more than dim the sunlight, their myriads of crystals refracted and scattered it in dazzling pyrotechnics. And as the sun moved behind the 1,000-mile-wide drifts of orbiting ice, pale ghosts of itself marched and merged across the sky, and the heavens were filled with shifting flares and flashes. Then the sun sank below the rings so that they framed it with their arches, and the celestial fireworks ceased. A little later, the ship curved into the shadow of Saturn as it made its closest approach over the night side of the planet. Above shone the stars and the rings. Below lay a dimly visible sea of clouds. There were none of the mysterious patterns of luminosity that had glowed in the Jovian night. Perhaps Saturn was too cold for such displays. The mottled cloudscape was revealed only by the ghostly radiance reflected back from the circling icebergs, still illuminated by the hidden sun. But in the center of the arch there was a wide, dark gap, like the missing span of an uncompleted bridge, where the shadow of the planet lay across its rings. Radio contact with Earth had been broken and could not be resumed until the ship emerged from the eclipsing bulk of Saturn. It was perhaps as well that Bowman was too busy now to think of his suddenly enhanced loneliness, For the next few hours, every second would be occupied as he checked the braking maneuvers already programmed by the computers on Earth. After their months of idleness, the main thrusters began to blast out their miles-long cataracts of glowing plasma. Gravity returned, though briefly, to the weightless world of the control deck, and hundreds of miles below, the clouds of methane and frozen ammonia blazed with a light that they had never known before as Discovery swept, a fierce and tiny sun, through the Saturnian night. At last, the pale dawn lay ahead. The ship, moving more and more slowly now, was emerging into day. It could no longer escape from the sun, or even from Saturn, but it was still moving swiftly enough to rise away from the planet until it grazed the orbit of Iapetus, 2 million miles out. It would take Discovery 14 days to make that climb, as she coasted once more, though in reverse order, across the paths of all the inner moons. One by one she would cut through the orbits of Janus, Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, Rhea, Titan, Hyperion, worlds bearing the names of gods and goddesses who had vanished only yesterday, as time was counted here. Then she would meet Iapetus, and must make her rendezvous. If she failed, she would fall back toward Saturn and repeat her 28-day ellipse indefinitely. There would be no chance for a second rendezvous if Discovery missed on this attempt. The next time around, Iapetus would be far away, almost on the other side of Saturn. It was true that they would meet again when the orbits of ship and satellite meshed for a second time, but that appointment was so many years ahead that, whatever happened, Bowman knew he would not witness it. Chapter 35. The Eye of Iapetus. When Bowman had first observed Iapetus, that curious elliptical patch of brilliance had been partly in shadow, illuminated only by the light of Saturn. Now, as the moon moved slowly along its 79-day orbit, it was emerging into the full light of day. As he watched it grow, and Discovery rose more and more sluggishly toward her inevitable appointment, Bowman became aware of a disturbing obsession. He never mentioned it in his conversations, or rather his running commentaries, with Mission Control, because it might have seemed that he was already suffering from delusions. Perhaps, indeed, he was, for he had half convinced himself that the bright ellipse set against the dark background of the satellite was a huge, empty eye, staring at him as he approached. It was an eye without a pupil, for nowhere could he see anything to mar its perfect blankness. Not until the ship was only 50,000 miles out, and Iapetus was twice as large as Earth's familiar moon, did he notice the tiny black dot at the exact center of the ellipse. But there was no time, then, for any detailed examination. The terminal maneuvers were already upon him. For the last time, Discovery's main drive released its energies. For the last time, the incandescent fury of dying atoms blazed among the moons of Saturn. To David Bowman, the far-off whisper and rising thrust of the jets brought a sense of pride and of sadness. The superb engines had done their duty with flawless efficiency. They had brought the ship from Earth to Jupiter to Saturn. Now this was the very last time that they would ever operate. When Discovery had emptied her propellant tanks, she would be as helpless and inert as any comet or asteroid, a powerless prisoner of gravitation. Even when the rescue ship arrived a few years hence, it would not be an economical proposition to refuel her so that she could fight her way back to Earth. She would be an eternal orbiting monument to the early days of planetary exploration. The thousands of miles shrank to hundreds, and as they did so, the fuel gauges dropped swiftly toward zero. At the control panel, Bowman's eyes flickered anxiously back and forth over the situation display and the improvised charts which he now had to consult for any real-time decisions. It would be an appalling anticlimax if, having survived so much, he failed to make rendezvous through lack of a few pounds of fuel. The whistle of the jets faded as the main thrust died and only the verniers continued to nudge Discovery gently into orbit. Iapetus was now a giant crescent that filled the sky. Until this moment, Bowman had always thought of it as a tiny, insignificant object, as indeed it was compared with the world around which it circled. Now, as it loomed menacingly above him, it seemed enormous, a cosmic hammer poised to crush Discovery like a nutshell. Iapetus was approaching so slowly that it scarcely seemed to move, and it was impossible to tell the exact moment when it made the subtle change from an astronomical body to a landscape only 50 miles below. The faithful verniers gave their last spurts of thrust, then closed down forever. The ship was in its final orbit, completing one revolution every 3 hours at a mere 800 miles an hour, all the speed that was required in this feeble gravitational field. Discovery had become a satellite of a satellite. Chapter 36. Big Brother.
I'm coming around to the daylight side again, and it's just as I reported on the last orbit. This place seems to have only two kinds of surface material. The black stuff looks burned, almost like charcoal, and with the same kind of texture as far as I can judge in the telescope. In fact, it reminds me very much of burned toast. I still can't make any sense of the wide area. It starts at an absolutely sharp-edged boundary and shows no surface detail at all. It could even be a liquid. It's flat enough. I don't know what impression you've got from the videos I've transmitted, but if you picture a sea of frozen milk, you'll get the idea exactly. It could even be some heavy gas. No, I suppose that's impossible. Sometimes I get the feeling that it's moving, very slowly, but I can never be sure. I'm over the white area again, on my third orbit. This time I hope to pass closer to that mark I spotted at its very center when I was on my way in. If my calculations are correct, I should go within 50 miles of it, whatever it is. Yes, there's something ahead just where I calculated. It's coming up over the horizon, and so is Saturn, in almost the same quarter of the sky. I'll move to the telescope.
Hello. It looks like some kind of building. Completely black, quite hard to see. No windows or any other features, just a big vertical slab. It must be at least a mile high to be visible from this distance. It reminds me... Of course. It's just like the thing you found on the moon. This is TMA-1's Big Brother. Chapter 37. Experiment. Call it the Stargate. For 3 million years it had circled Saturn, waiting for a moment of destiny that might never come. In its making, a moon had been shattered, and the debris of its creation orbited still. Now the long wait was ending. On yet another world, intelligence had been born and was escaping from its planetary cradle. An ancient experiment was about to reach its climax. Those who had begun that experiment so long ago had not been men, or even remotely human. But they were flesh and blood, and when they looked out across the deeps of space, they had felt awe and wonder and loneliness. As soon as they possessed the power, they set forth for the stars. In their explorations, they encountered life in many forms and watched the workings of evolution on 1,000 worlds. They saw how often the first faint sparks of intelligence flickered and died in the cosmic night. And because, in all the galaxy, they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the fields of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. The great dinosaurs had long since perished when the survey ship entered the solar system after a voyage that had already lasted 1,000 years. It swept past the frozen outer planets, paused briefly above the deserts of dying Mars, and presently looked down on Earth. Spread out beneath them, the explorers saw a world swarming with life. For years they studied, collected, cataloged. When they had learned all that they could, they began to modify. They tinkered with the destiny of many species, on land and in the ocean, but which of their experiments would succeed, they could not know for at least 1 million years. They were patient, but they were not yet immortal. There was so much to do in this universe of 100 billion suns, and other worlds were calling. So they set out once more into the abyss, knowing that they would never come this way again. Nor was there any need. The servants they had left behind would do the rest. On Earth, the glaciers came and went, while above them the changeless moon still carried its secret. With a yet slower rhythm than the polar ice, the tides of civilization ebbed and flowed across the galaxy.
Strange and beautiful and terrible empires rose and fell and passed on their knowledge to their successors. Earth was not forgotten, but another visit would serve little purpose. It was one of a million silent worlds, few of which would ever speak. And now, out among the stars, evolution was driving toward new goals. The first explorers of Earth had long since come to the limits of flesh and blood. As soon as their machines were better than their bodies, it was time to move. First their brains, and then their thoughts alone, they transferred into shining new homes of metal and of plastic. In these they roamed among the stars. They no longer built spaceships. They were spaceships. But the age of the machine entities swiftly passed. In their ceaseless experimenting, they had learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. They could become creatures of radiation, free at last from the tyranny of matter. Into pure energy, therefore, they presently transformed themselves, and on a thousand worlds, the empty shells they had discarded twitched for a while in a mindless dance of death, then crumbled into rust. Now they were lords of the galaxy, and beyond the reach of time. They could rove at will among the stars and sink like a subtle mist through the very interstices of space. But despite their godlike powers, they had not wholly forgotten their origin in the warm slime of a vanished sea, and they still watched over the experiments their ancestors had started so long ago. Chapter 38, The Sentinel. The air in the ship is getting quite foul, and I have a headache most of the time. There's still plenty of oxygen, but the purifiers never really cleaned up all the messes after the liquids aboard started boiling in a vacuum. When things get too bad, I go down into the garage and bleed off some pure oxygen from the pods.
This is the end of Disc 5. Please continue listening on Disc number 6.